Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in 10 minutes, former Governor Jim McGreevy resurfaces to praise a Christie drug program. Jim McGreevy in about 10 minutes. Right now, the crisis in Syria is deepening day by day, and nobody is quite sure what to do about it. The United Nations Security Council decided yesterday to back an Arab League peace plan, but only after removing the call for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down from power. Individual countries still have to vote, and it's not clear, especially whether Russia will give the okay. In the meantime, estimates are that 6,000 people have been killed in Syria since the violence there began last March. Sarah Leewitz, an executive director for the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, joins me now to talk about the conditions on the ground in Syria and what diplomacy might do to help in these latest developments. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
We're now waiting to hear, first of all, about whether the UN resolution on the Arab League plan will pass, and particularly if Russia, which has a veto in the Security Council, will approve it. Russia did not approve of a similar resolution in October. What does the Arab League plan call for?
Well, the Arab League plan calls for President Assad to step down and for his vice president to take power while a new government is formed, and the opposition can, of course, play a part in that. I should say the various opposition voices should be able to play a part in that. It also, of course, calls for an end to the violence. It calls for the Syrian government to cooperate with the UN's human rights investigators to allow access to human rights investigators and the media, all things that were part of the Arab League monitoring plan and that the Syrian government has breached and violated or ignored.
You referenced one way in which this plan had been watered down originally from its original version, or watered down recently from its original version, that the transition would be Assad transferring power to a vice president rather than the regime leaving power entirely. But what does it mean if the resolution is ultimately adopted? Syria agreed to another Arab League plan in December when it agreed to allow monitors into the country, and that mission was suspended when it became simply too dangerous for them to stay in Syria. The Arab League has also imposed sanctions on Syria, so I'm just curious what you think the actual practical effects would be, even if this resolution at the Security Council is approved.
I think if the resolution at the UN Security Council is approved, it's a major ground shifter, and it's a major signal to President Assad that he really has no one to count on anymore. And it's true that the current draft of the Security Council resolution is significantly watered down and much weaker than what the Arab League has called for. But if Russia goes along with it, and behind Russia will be China and Pakistan, then it will send a very strong message to the Syrian government. And to President Assad in particular, that his time is really up. And the current draft of the Security Council resolution at least does speak in terms of political transition, and it does not include an agreement to suspend all arms sales to Syria, because Russia has made clear that they want to continue to do that. But if there's a unanimous Security Council resolution that includes the notion of political transition, it, I think, will send a very important signal to President Assad. Will it be enough to end the violence? That, you know, will remain to be seen. And President Assad certainly is not the first dictator to think that he could make it through and keep up the fight. And just look at, of course, at Muammar Gaddafi, who really did go down fighting. But hopefully, President Assad will make different calculations.
The number that's been frequently reported is that 6,000 people have been killed in Syria in the past 11 months. In December, your group, Human Rights Watch, released a lengthy report based on interviews with defectors from the Syrian military. And we have a clip of one of those interviews from a defector who, for obvious reasons, is remaining anonymous.
Two snipers was commanders of me. They say before they go to the roof of the building, they just say, let us go for hunting. When protesters go to streets, they go to the roof of the building, a high building, and use AK-47 or a sniper sniper rifle to shoot on the protesters on the street.
So, Sarah Lee, that's a pretty horrific picture that he paints. Let's go for hunting. When protesters go to the street, they go to the roof of a high building and they use AK-47s or sniper rifles to shoot on the protesters in the street. Do other reports that you have at Human Rights Watch confirm that that's the way the government is behaving?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, in addition to the testimony you just cited, we had dozens of defectors telling us about the orders they received of shoot to kill. And in fact, it's the reason why so many of them have defected. The reason why so many Arab League monitors recently resigned from the Arab League monitoring was because of their own witnessing of snipers, government snipers on buildings, shooting at people, stepping out of their homes, stepping out during these imposed curfews. The death toll makes clear that the government is really trying to instill a campaign of terror to give people to give up in their protest against the government.
And I see that Human Rights Watch has just released another disturbing report today on how children are also being detained and tortured and targeted in Syria. The United Nations has also reported that hundreds of children have been killed in the crackdown. What did your report find?
Well, our report, in fact, finds not only that children have been killed sort of as collateral or as part of the general campaign against protesters throughout the country, as well as sort of incidental attacks on people's homes, shootings, bombings, and so forth, but also children have been deliberately targeted by security forces who have invaded schools, you know, come into schools to pursue why there have been, for example, anti-Assad graffiti at various schools and arresting children there. We now have testimony from children who have been detained and subjected to horrific abuse, including electric shock, in some cases as young as 13 and 14. And I thought I would just recall that part of the reason, part of the incident that caused the protests and uprisings in Syria to spiral was the arrest and torture of about half a dozen or a dozen high school children in Daraa in Syria, who were arrested and brutally tortured because they were among the first to start demonstrating against President Assad.
What are you hearing from Syria today, if you're in touch by the hour? It is a Friday, meaning it's a day of prayer, which is generally a big day for protests. And today, the opposition activists are urging Syrians to mark the 30th anniversary of the 1982 massacre in the city of Hama, which was ordered by President Assad's father. The anniversary was officially yesterday, but today, being Friday, there's an expectation that the protest will be huge. Can you tell us what you're seeing and maybe the very short version of Hama for people who don't know, where the death toll has been estimated at anywhere from 10,000 to 40,000 people?
Well, yes, 30 years ago this month, the Assad family carried out a brutal campaign of murder in Hama to quell an Islamist uprising at the time in Hama as well as in Homs, parts of Homs. That resulted in the murder of what's estimated to be at least 10,000 people. And 30 years later, there's never been any investigation, and there's been complete and utter impunity for the bloodshed in Hama. And I think it's very important to note that these things don't go away and they're not forgotten. And there's a reason why Hama today is a hotbed of the uprising and the hatred of President Assad, because it's not just the everyday repression that people experience, but the fact that so many of their family members were killed without any consequence, without any recognition of what their families and of course, the victims themselves suffered. And these protests have been called for today. They have called for, you know, an anniversary commemoration of what happened there in the country, but people are also under lock and key in a way because of the fact that Syrian security forces are deployed in so many parts throughout the country and have been so quick to pull the trigger on people. So I expect to see that there will be pockets of demonstrations, pockets of commemorations, and an uptick in the violence, but it may well also be that people lie low because the violence is so intensified and the Syrian government has shown absolutely no mercy and no pity on ordinary Syrians.
And so, lastly, the version that I'm seeing right now from the Voice of America News Service is that this Security Council resolution seems to be bogged down. It says members of the UN Security Council are considering today a new draft resolution to end the bloodshed in Syria with an amendment designed to overcome Russian objections. It says UN ambassadors say the new draft will be sent back to their governments for evaluation. So that sounds like it will take some time, but it is not clear whether the revision will gain approval by the 15-member council. Is that your sense, that this is bogged down now? And what is Russia's objection to this?
Well, it is bogged down, although we are having reports that it may be voted on as early as tonight or tomorrow. The Russian-specific objections have had to do with inserting a provision, which I know the current draft contains, that specifically makes clear that this resolution is not authorizing military force, watering down references to political transition, and eliminating references to a suspension of arms sales to Syria. I think part of Russia's hesitation, of course, a big part is the fact that it's allied with Syria and has a military base in Syria and has continued to supply the Syrian government with weapons. But part of the reason why it's been able to keep a chokehold on the Syria resolution and have alongside it initially, of course, South Africa, India, and Brazil, and since the election of new members, Pakistan as well, with South Africa's departure and India's departure, is sort of a fallback or a ricocheting of their anger and frustration at what happened at the Libya Security Council resolution authorizing force, where their sentiment is that the Western powers used that resolution authorizing military intervention, ostensibly designed for the protection of civilians, that sort of was a slippery slope to an all-out campaign, an aggressive campaign, an active campaign, and not just a defensive campaign, to oust Gaddafi and to oust the Gaddafi government. And they are very wary of seeing that kind of a military campaign against President Assad. And, you know, I think to a certain extent that's been their primary public argument, because there is a lot of discomfort globally, particularly in the global south, with Western campaigns of military intervention.
Sarah Lee Whitson, Executive Director for the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Jim McGreevy, next.